Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
So I invited Eileen Fisher on. You're going to hear from her. I'll introduce her in a moment. She's a huge name in the fashion industry. And in many ways, I thought, to borrow a phrase that I used in my book, I thought that this interview was going to be kind of like a two animal species trying to talk to one another who are like not of the same species, like a lizard trying to talk to a goat, because we're so different. But she's incredibly interesting, and I learned a lot, and I think you'll hear some huge areas of overlap. So here you go. Here's Eileen Fisher. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. I'm going to start with the question that I ask everybody at first, which is how, when, where, why did you start meditating?
Oh, great. Love that question. I think I'm a person who's sort of always been kind of a seeker. I'm a little different type than you're sort of targeting, maybe. I'm the sort of tree hugger gal.
You mean you...
the ones you kind of mock a little bit. So I'm kind of...
You mean I make fun of people like you, is what
you're
saying.
Right, probably.
Yeah, but I still love people like you.
Yeah.
I make fun of... I try to do it with a loving...
I know you do. You're hysterical. I adore it. Anyway, so I guess around... So I do my things. I started doing therapy years ago and journaling and all kinds of different sort of seeker, you know, ways to know myself. I'm always trying to know who I am and what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and, you know, what's impacting me and all those kinds of things. So I think around 15 years ago, I went probably on my first yoga retreat. And I hadn't really done yoga before that. And while I was doing yoga, we started always with meditation for half an hour every morning. And I was just kind of taken with how blissful I felt. I didn't know it was possible to be free of the chatter in my mind. And so I was loved that. But then I went home and I committed to 5 minutes every day.
Can I stop you right
yes.
there for a second? Because most people, their initial experience of meditation is not bliss. It's
right.
like torture.
Right.
You know,
right.
because you're
right.
just really seeing how crazy you are. So what is your mind like that was awesome for you?
All right. Well, keep in mind, I was on vacation in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So that contributed to it. And we were meditating, overlooking the water. And, you know, so it's particularly gorgeous. And then I did yoga right after that. So it was this kind of, and then we went swimming and, you know, beautiful meals and all those things. So it was kind of a whole package. And it was later, and when I got home and I tried to do the 5 minutes, that I got in trouble and that I was not able to follow through. You know, and I tried. I went back another, you know, for 5 years, and I tried really hard to anchor at least a minimal 5 minute practice and for 5 years. And wasn't very successful. And I think for exactly the reasons that you're talking about, is that I would face myself and my own mind that was pretty chaotic.
It's a collision with reality.
Right, exactly.
You really see how crazy we all are.
Crazy. I still, you know, even after years of meditating, I still wake up every morning crazy, feeling crazy. And I have to sit up and meditate or my mind will get the better of me.
So it's the first thing you do in the morning?
First thing, every morning. Yeah.
Well, to your...
But I didn't finish how I got into it then, how I actually... But go ahead, Keith.
But I just want to say, in your defense, if you didn't wake up a little crazy...
I would be really crazy.
Yeah, given the size
or aware
of,
that I was crazy.
Right. I mean, given the size of the organization you're running,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
it's got... I just... The amount...
But I have so many good people, you know, so I don't...
Sure, but when an issue reaches you, it's
yeah.
probably a problem.
That's true. That is true.
So anyway, yeah, just
hard decision has to be made.
Of course. So I just wanted to say that in your defense. But anyway, back to your story.
Acknowledging that load that I carry. Yeah, it is overwhelming.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about that and what whether meditation helps. But
yeah.
But back anyway, you were telling me. So you did it. You tried 5 minutes a day, and
right. And
you
I tried over a 5 year period. I kept going back to that retreat. I'd do yoga classes, and I tried meditating, and I couldn't. I'd do it at night or in the morning. I couldn't sort of anchor it. And then I ended up at the Chopra Center about 10 years ago, and I did a program called Emotional Freedom, because I knew that I was like I was triggered too easily by things and emotionally kind of hijacked too often in my life. And so, like, a problem would become some thing in my mind. And so I wanted to get free of the emotional chaos that I was in. And so that's why I went to this program. But, of course, what they taught was meditation. So basically what they said that really worked for me was get up, meditate first thing in the morning. They gave me this phrase, rise, pee, meditate. And it worked. It worked.
That may be the only Deepak Chopra catchphrase that I like.
Yeah, probably.
No,
it's a
I
good
mean,
one,
I,
though, and it works.
No, actually, that's probably unfair to Deepak. He probably says a lot of things I like.
Yeah.
But I also like to make fun of him a little bit.
Yeah.
So that worked for you, and at that point, it stuck?
It stuck, and I've been doing it ever since.
And what is your, how long do you go?
So I go between 10 minutes and 30 minutes, depends on what else I'm doing. So I have to do yoga in the morning, too, because I really need the physical piece. And so I'll do yoga for a minimum of 10 minutes, and I'll meditate for a minimum of 10 minutes. But if I have more time, I try to do 30, but many days I don't do 30. I do 10 and 10 usually.
And what is the actual technique you're doing when you meditate?
Ah, okay, that's good. So when I first started at the Chopra Center, I got I started using a mantra and, you know, just kind of repeating the phrase. I don't even remember what the phrase is. And then I got involved with kind of Buddhist meditation and doing, I went on a 7-day silent retreat, probably six, seven years ago.
Wow. Where?
In Colorado at Red Feather, Shambhala Center.
Huh. Okay, yeah, Shambhala Center.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that place specifically, but the Shambhala Center was founded by Chogyam Trungpa, who's famous and infamous at the same time.
Right, exactly.
A Tibetan monk who, I guess, took the robes off and lived a lay life, but has a big following that remains to this day. I have a lot of friends who are... who are active members.
Oh, good. So do I. Yeah, that's good. I'll have to compare notes. Yeah, we actually do that on Sunday mornings. We have a group that meets in our office in Westchester.
Oh, so it's a Shambhala group.
It's a Shambhala group.
Well, the guy who profiled you for Mindful Magazine.
Oh, right.
Barry Boyce, who's a close friend and advisor of mine.
Great. He's great.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
I call him like the beat reporter for mindfulness. He's like, He really is like a guy you would meet covering City Hall in Dayton in some ways. But that he knows everybody in the mindfulness
world.
He's
actually, his hometown is Pennsylvania, where my ex-husband is from.
So oh, really?
A little town in Pennsylvania.
So he has a working class vibe to him, like a working class journalist vibe to him. But he's also, as are almost all working class journalists I've met, really sharp, really smart, really plugged in.
Yeah.
And he's a long time Shambhala practitioner.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I think I've taken us astray narratively.
That was a fun article to do with him. Yeah, I liked him.
I recommend it to everybody. You can find the PDFs online. I read it. It's one of the many things I read in preparation for this interview with you. And Mindful Magazine is a great magazine.
Yeah, it's good.
I believe you were on the cover.
Yes.
You're a cover girl.
Oh, God.
Any magazine that's putting you on the cover, that's a good thing, especially since the mindfulness, now I'm getting into a real tangent here, but mindfulness hasn't had a house organ, you know what I mean? Like a central repository for information, and Mindful Magazine has really done that quite well.
And brought it out more in the secular world,
I think.
Made it accessible.
So you started doing Shambhala meditation. Is that what you still do?
Yeah, I do. Basically, it's just following my breath and trying to bring my mind back to following my breath, because even now, after many years, my mind, as you know, it just constantly needs to be pulled back. And so that's what I do. And I also do a loving kindness meditation some mornings, most mornings.
And is that something you learned through Shambhala or elsewhere?
No, I actually learned it through Barbara Fredrickson.
Sure.
Her book.
Is she a scientist?
I believe.
or a researcher of some sort.
Yeah, some sort. Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard her name.
Love 2.0, her book is what I read. That was fantastic.
She, I think, now I'm speaking from ignorance here, so I just want to be upfront. I think she's done some work with Sharon Salzberg, who is a major proponent in the meditation world for loving-kindness meditation.
That's right. Yeah, love. It's all about love, isn't it?
You know, I have to say, as a lifelong, you know, nihilistic skeptic and sarcastic wise ass, and I've talked about this in the podcast before, I mean, I am a real believer in loving-kindness meditation, which is this practice where you visualize people and systematically send them good vibes. And I often make the joke that it initially sounds like Valentine's Day with a machete to your throat. Right. It's just really like enforced gooiness. but the science shows it works. And it works in interesting ways. It has health benefits. So it lowers the release of stress hormones and things like that. But it can change behavior.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, for example, children, preschoolers who are taught how to do this kind of meditation are more likely to give their stickers away to kids they don't know.
Oh, how sweet.
It's really sweet. And as the father of a 1.5-year-old, I need to get around to teaching this kid because he won't give me anything.
Well, I can say for myself, I'm more... I can find myself welcoming people in a more warm way. You know, even people that I maybe don't feel comfortable with or... not sure if I actually like, but I can feel, you know, sort of energetically that I feel that I'm more able to be warmer with people.
Why do you think that is? Is it?
I think my mind got tricked into thinking. No, I don't know. I don't actually know. I think it's practicing that particular meditation that I do. I think it shifts something. It makes. It's sort of like you trick your mind. It's like laughter yoga or something. Mm. They say that it actually you start to feel happier. Or I noticed you interviewed Amy Cuddy. You know, all that. That if you change your body,
power poses.
You know, you change your mind. If you change your mind, you change your behavior. I think it's almost like tricking ourselves. Is that strange?
Or you could say training yourself.
Training. That's better. I like that better. Yeah.
It may be a mix of the two. But I wonder, you know, sometimes when it, as it pertains to mindfulness, loving kindness meditation and behavior change, is it, obviously you're training the part of the brain that is compassionate, but there's a cognitive component too, right?
Yeah.
So like when you see somebody, and I'm sure in your line of work, you see a lot of people, some percentage of them are going to be difficult people for you.
Yeah.
Is there
all
some-
All of us in all of our lives.
Of course. But
my
your
most
life-
most difficult person is my son, therefore, so it's not just at work.
Fair enough. How old is your son?
27.
Okay, well.
That's a good age for difficultness.
I have a son, too, so I can get
a little one,
some,
though, don't
I
you?
I have a little one, but he's I have, let's talk about that, too, at some point, parenting.
Yes.
There's a cognitive component, too, because you can see, and maybe this is kind of what's drummed into us through doing the practice and reading about it and learning about it. You see that even if this person is difficult for you, they want the same thing you do, which is to be happy,
right?
Not to suffer.
That's right.
And that is just a useful intellectual reframing of the thing.
Right. That's good. I like that.
Reframe. What other impacts did this doing this mix of mindfulness meditation and loving kindness have on your life? Because you have a son. You have an ex-husband. You also run this Goliath of an institution. So how else did you find it useful? Well, look, I mean, I run...
It's all relative.
I have structured my life so that nobody reports to me. So I don't run anything. So sitting here with somebody who has 1,200 employees, that seems like a Goliath of an institution to me, at least.
Yeah. It is. I guess the impacts that I see is that... I think I'm different. I think I'm able to kind of show up in a little more whole way. And I think that it's affecting the work. I think the work, I care more about the work itself and not just the product that we create, but the whole of the work from the way people work together, the way we treat each other, you know, the way we try to help create an environment where people can grow. And also the way we treat the workers and the way we care about the planet. I think that all of those things have sort of shifted. And I don't, it's not, I mean, I meditate, but I think it's more than that. I think we actually, I don't know if you know, but in the workplace, we ring the bell and we have a moment of silence before meetings. Did you hear about this?
I did hear about that, yes.
Did that really scare you? Like,
no.
Oh my God, that's so weird.
No. I mean, look, probably if you had told me this 8 years ago, I would have thought it was weird because that was before I was meditating.
Is that a cult or something really weird going on over there?
Maybe. But now I think, you know, I debate it. Because I have meetings, I have a little company that teaches people how to meditate through an app, and we don't do that at the beginning of our meetings. And I think it's partly because culturally we're trying to position ourselves as meditation for people who are not weird, right? Who don't think they're weird,
the
right?
Skeptics, I like it. Yeah.
Yes, and
it's for anyone, really. Though.
It is for everyone.
Really, I love what you're doing. I think
Thank
it's
you.
Really good.
I appreciate
it's really
that.
Important because I think to take it out further and to let people know. How helpful it can be, and I want to say one other thing about the work situation because it's
say as much as you want.
Well, I think what's really interesting, and I think it is this kind of idea of stopping and having a little space and creating awareness of what are we doing and why are we doing it and how are we doing it and how could we do it better. I think it's the kind of reframing that needs to happen in the whole. World of work. I think that we can make a much bigger difference in the world through the workplace if we change our level of consciousness, so that we actually can tap into the energy that everyone has and the positive energy rather than the negative in the crazy minds that we can bring to things and all our weird patterns in past. And I have this consultant. He says that 90% of what we bring into the workplace is our childhood patterns. And so we're always acting out and being triggered by people and, all kinds of weird things, But if we could free that up and we could get that other 90% of energy from people, then we could really, we could really use the energy of people in the workplace to really make a big difference, like what you're doing.
Thank you. I think what you said is 1,000% true. I guess the question goes back to what we were discussing before. How do you introduce it in a way that it doesn't seem weird, right?
Right. Well, actually, probably when we did it, it might have seemed a little bit weird. But we have a culture that, we've drawn in a kind of, I think maybe the kind of clothes we make, the kind of the way we work, we've drawn in a certain kind of employee that tends to care about well-being and these kinds of things. So it's not so weird in our environment. But we had these consultants who've been working for us for many years, and they now take the practice out into other organizations, and they don't call it meditation or even mindfulness. They just say it's a moment to pause before starting a meeting. Just take a moment to pause. And, we need to gather. We need to let go of where we came from and the last meeting we're in and worrying about whatever else we're worried about and just be present to this meeting and to this moment.
Yeah, I mean, you could call it a sanity break.
Right. And a lot of people do. People do different things. I have a skeptic in my office. He says, I count to 60 every time we do that. And that's okay,
Absolutely.
And I think it still gives you a little break. And other people say, oh, God, we forgot to ring the bell. We need a moment. Or sometimes in the middle of a meeting, wow, that was a really important idea, or that was an important thought. And someone will say, let's just take a moment, and they'll ring the bell. But how to do it and so it's not weird, and so that moment of pause, or that sanity break, let's take a sanity break. Or sometimes a stretch break, like, would people do that? Would that be weird? We do that, too.
You're all in. You've done it all.
I mean,
you've got massage therapists walking around the office. I think it's easier for you. You set the tone for culture in the company. The company's named after you. People are drawn to you.
If people think it's weird, they don't come.
Probably not. But for other employers, I think it's trickier. You get into the whole issue of secularity and are you enforcing something on people?
Right. And we're trying to actually. I'm not helping you with your goal here, but we're trying to actually go get people to go deeper, to actually really work on their other 90% that hold us back. You know,
so how do you get them to do that?
I've recently started a learning lab. I don't know if you're aware of that, but the idea is that people go off-site and work on, you know, purpose and embodiment is something I'm interested in.
What do you mean by that?
How do we show up fully in ourselves, in our bodies, and, you know, and how do we notice what we're feeling and thinking, and, you know, how do we keep referencing ourselves, our own bodies, in the midst of whatever else is going on? So how do I know, like, oh, I'm a little intimidated in this conversation, or I'm a little uncomfortable.
Please tell me you're not intimidated.
I'm not intimidated, okay. But often, you know, I'll find myself in a situation where I'm become aware that I've just shut down, or I'm not listening, really hearing what's happening, or I'm not bringing my full self to the, or my, I'm not responding. Like, one of the things, maybe this is, that I have this problem, I shut down and I can't hear, or I can't speak sometimes, because, and I can't bring my voice to the situation because something has scared me or something. So I'm learning to notice, you know, my pattern. It's a childhood pattern for me of shutdown. That's how I coped with all kinds of difficult situations in my family. Just shut down, you know, hang out with myself. So learning about that and actually learning that I can stop and I can make a different choice. Oh, I can actually show up. I can actually speak up here. I can actually listen better. I can actually ask that person to repeat, because sometimes I'll just say, whoa, I just missed that. Could you just repeat that? I just really want to hear you. And just realizing that I, you know, as I become more aware of what I'm feeling and noticing inside, that I can make different choices. And then in doing that, I show up differently. I can make different decisions. Like, I told this story recently. We're in the midst of shifting around our leadership group and hiring a few new key executives. And I was interviewing marketing people, and I found myself, like, you know, noticing, like, being able to step back and notice, whoa, I'm shutting down. I'm actually uncomfortable. I'm afraid of this person. And so she's really smart. She really has a lot of background. I don't even know how to ask questions. And so I caught myself doing that, and I was able to go, whoa, to myself. I missed a fair amount of that interview. She's pretty interesting, but in the past I would probably go, like, no, I didn't really connect with her, or something didn't feel right. And then I realized, no, that was me, and that was my fear, and that was me shutting down. And so afterwards I said, I think maybe we need to interview her again, because I don't think I fully heard all of what was happening. And so now, I'm not going to finish that whole story, but I think we've created a whole new path of, for me, I'm more open to people that I might have actually not let in to the company. So I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be a huge win for the company, because I'm able to kind of reference myself and open up more.
You know what strikes me sitting here talking to you? Because we said you said in a very charming way at the beginning that you think that you're maybe the type of person that I kind of make fun of once
right.
in a while. But we're saying the exact same thing. We just use different language.
Oh, is that it?
I wouldn't probably say embodied, but it's a... It is a super legitimate idea. If you're feeling, we call them feelings for a reason. You feel them in your body.
Right.
If you're stuck in your own head
and
you're not in touch with whatever's happening in your actual body, you are going to miss stuff. And you will get trapped by all of your conditioning, all the stuff in your past, all the stuff you're worried about.
Yeah.
And so what you're talking about right now is completely commonsensical.
Right. But I'm saying it in language that's a little less accessible, so that's very
interesting. No, I mean, to me, but I'm just one person, man. I think it's going to be incredibly accessible to lots of people.
Yeah.
I don't think this was not a critique at all. This was just more like I think we have we have very similar views on these issues. It's just a matter of we may just say it differently.
But and the. Well, back to the embodiment topic, though, because I'm really fascinated. But
a
you're absolutely
great topic.
Right. The language is really important, and Barry talks about that. And when he, you know, Barry Boyce from Mindfulness, Mindful Magazine, talks about the right language that makes it accessible so more people are invited in, so we're not shutting people out.
He had me do a joint column with him, something like 7 ways to talk about meditation without being annoying or something like
right,
that.
That's great.
So yeah, it's a trick. It is a trick. But, you know,
go ahead. If I was going to say more about it, but it's
no,
okay.
No, please do. Please do, because then I have a follow-up question after that.
Okay, and I'm trying to remember what I was going to say.
Well, I'll ask you the question, and if you get to it, then that's fine. You said you were trying to get in the direction of getting your employees to go deeper. And right. One of the things that in the lab that you talk about is embodiment. That's how we got
right.
to embodiment in
the
learning
Purpose,
lab.
Embodiment.
Exactly.
Leadership.
And so how do you as an employer draw the line between being the employer and being like psychotherapist
and
nanny and all that? But you're providing people with things that most employers don't and might see as like beyond the purview of an employer.
Right. Well, I guess the way I see it is that if people get freed up and we can sort of get this other part of energy, you know, that's actually held in their, that gets in their way, the obstacles, the, you know, all of that. If we can free that up, then it's good for business.
See, now you're talking like me. Yes.
It's all connected, you know, and it's not the full intention. And for me, kind of, it's deeper because I really care that if we fully engage people in deeper ways, they're going to do deeper, more interesting work. They're going to bring much more to what they do. And I think that's what our company wants, and I think that's what the world needs.
There's no mutual exclusivity here. Right. Motivation is an interesting thing because we can there are lots of levels.
I like the way you frame it. See, I wasn't thinking about that word, but that's exactly right.
I feel like, you know, if I think about decisions.
Let's do a project together. That would be fun.
Let's do a project together.
Re-language it.
Absolutely.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
I think about things that I'm working on or decisions I'm making. And I always think there's like a spectrum of motivation. So sometimes it ranges from crass to really high-minded.
Right.
You know, my book.
Feed the monster. We got to feed the monster.
No. Well, there's that true.
the beast.
Of course. Feed the beast is part of every business, certainly in –
Well, we could argue that, but let's talk about – no, that's a different conversation. We'll have
let's talk about that too. There's so many things I want to ask you. But feeding the beast in my line of work in journalism really means that we have these shows. You know, 2 hours a morning for Good Morning America and a half hour for World News Tonight and half hour for Nightline. And we need to feed that beast. We need to feed the beast. That content for those shows. And so you can be really focused on getting the content for every night's show. But then sometimes that can create a tunnel vision.
Right. That's good.
But Same with clothes. Of course. Fall line, spring line.
We got to do it. And customers want to know what's next. And so we got to do it. But at the same time, you know,
how do you have a larger
vision? How do you keep the quality and the content the way you want it and not compromise and at the same time, you know, get the work done and meet the deadlines and do what you need to do to keep it moving.
Yeah, feed that beast while also having the large enough vision and view to say, oh, we need to set up a learning lab or we need to do these other things for our employees.
Right.
On the issue of motivation, I just what I was going to say is like even if you take writing I wrote a book. What was my motivation? I wanted on one level it was pretty high minded. I wanted to make meditation accessible to millions of people who would otherwise not like it. On the other hand, you know, it built my personal brand in some ways, right? So there's some of that is not. That's part of my motivation for doing that isn't stuff that I'm super proud of, right?
Uh-huh.
But some of it is. And that is, you know, when you talk before about why you're doing this kind of deep work with your employees, it can range from,
this is good for business.
It's good for business to these are people I care about. They're around me every day.
Right. I want them to be happy.
Exactly.
It's all, Yeah, it can be win-win-win. Can kind of get it all.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you. because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile, third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
The other thing you do in your business.
But I do. I want to also ask you about the 10% happier concept. But
go ahead. No, go ahead.
And then you can ask me more about my business. So I was thinking about 10% happier, and I wanted to ask you, are you 10% happier?
My view now is, first of all, it was a joke.
I know.
It was a joke. But my view now is that the 10% compounds annually.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like any
so
good
happier
investment.
And happier.
Of course. I'm terrible at math, but I kind of think about it geographically. That there's an x-axis, you know, that runs horizontally, I think. I can't remember. But anyway, so we have this happiness set point, right, that
right.
Psychologists say that, you know, if you think about a graph and the whatever is running horizontally, if I think it's the x-axis, that good things happen and we tend to go above the set point and
right.
We're psyched.
That's cool. Yeah.
But then we revert back to it eventually.
Right.
And then bad things happen, we go below.
Right.
And then we come, but we, you
right.
know, we get over it. We come right. back to the happiness set point. I sort of feel like what meditation has done for me is that it's made the high higher.
Right.
But not in a manic way. It's just that
right.
I'm not so busy thinking about what's next.
Right.
That
you
I actually enjoy it.
Actually
yes.
Take it in. Right.
Like having a kid. There's a lot of stuff
right.
that's really enjoyable
nice.
About having a kid.
Yeah.
And then on the lower stuff that I feel like it helps make the trough shallower because I'm more resilient, less prone to useless rumination about my problems. And then what it
yeah.
also does is it moves the happiness set point up.
That's cool. I like that. So one of the things I've observed is also that I notice that though I'm happier, I'm also sadder when I'm sad.
Because you're actually feeling the
thing.
Because
I'm actually feeling it. Yeah. So that's an observation that's interesting to me.
It can also
it's all good.
It's also true. I feel like there's an adolescent stage of practice, which I'm
yes.
definitely in, where
yeah.
you see how crazy you are.
Right.
And like you're seeing it more. You
right.
know, you're seeing it more
right,
than
right,
you
right.
used to because
exactly.
before you were, you know, hiding it. And that's
exactly.
an awkward stage.
You're letting yourself see it. And that's
absolutely.
So it's not for the faint of heart, this meditation at a certain point. It takes courage. Yeah.
I think it does.
I think that's why it was. Those first 5 years, hard to do those 5 minutes because it takes a certain courage just to be with yourself and the weirdness that we are, you know? I mean, the chaotic mind and the strange things. I mean, I still, like I was telling you earlier, still wake up every morning with this kind of anxiety and strange, you know, thoughts, where, you know, like worrying about problems. And until I sit and meditate, I, you know, I can't kind of get a handle on it.
Yeah. And it's not like the meditation makes it go away.
No. That's why I was saying about 10% happier. It doesn't make it go away, but you can handle it better. You can be with things that you might not have been able to be with, I think. Like I often talk about my mother. She was lived with depression, you know, and it was really hard to be around her. 7 kids, I don't blame her. I'd have been depressed too. But, you know, she always believed that the only way to cure her depression was to get to the doctor and get the medication right. And then if the medication wasn't right, then she was going into another depression. And she was always worried that big black cloud was going to descend on her again. So she never felt she had any choice in the matter. And so for me, that's what's most interesting about meditation is that it gives us that opportunity to choose, to say that I don't have to live in this state of depression. I have a tool that's powerful. I can do this, or I can do yoga, or I can eat differently, or I can change my relationship if it's not working, or, you know, I actually have a choice, and that's powerful.
I understand your mother getting frantic about that stuff, because
right.
when that depression, I mean, I've had it, it's bleak, and you would do anything to avoid it.
Right.
But your mother just didn't have the tools.
Right.
Nobody offered her anything else.
Right.
I'm guessing.
That's true. Shock treatment, drugs, That was it.
Well, she was in the Dark Ages.
And back to the Seven Kids.
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. So we were.
Sorry, I didn't mean to change the subject.
No,
others,
no, you're like batting a thousand. Everything you're saying is interesting. I just wanted to make. I wanted to get back to your running the business.
The business. All right, yeah.
Because the other thing you do, aside from, it sounds like a great place to work because you, as I said before, you have got meditation rooms, you've got people come around giving massages, you have all this profit sharing.
Oh, right, profit sharing. And ESOP, we, you know, 40% owned by the employees.
Oh, really?
You didn't know that. Yeah, yeah.
I read something about at least 10% of the after-tax money went back to employees.
25.
25 now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So aside from being very generous with your employees, you've done a lot of work on the supply chain, uh-huh. on the conditions.
The planet's sustainability, that
absolutely.
Kind of thing. Yes, yeah.
Now, I'm wondering, I see the why this makes sense from a global perspective,
yeah.
But does it make sense what you're doing from a business perspective?
Well, I think it depends on how long-term you think about business. You know, so you could think of it just straight from a business standpoint that we need to protect our brand and our image, if you're just crassly thinking about it from that standpoint, that we don't want to be called out for, you know, situations in our factories that are not consistent with the way that we present ourselves. So that alone, just PR reasons, is a business reason to do it. That's not what motivated us in the first place. I think it really came from, you know, the kind of people that we draw into our company that just are more willing to open their eyes and see in a bigger way and, you know, didn't like things that they saw in the factories and that, you know, whether it was the way people were treated or, you know, just things, fair pay, health, things of that nature that, you know, we wanted to make right. And the same for sustainability. We have probably, I don't even know how many people in the company. Across the company, there are probably 50 people who are regularly involved in our sustainability efforts. And actually what it does in terms of business is those people are actually more motivated. You know, if they're a sustainability ambassador or if they feel that, and it's true, that their work is more meaningful, that they're not just producing things that are hurting people in the way they're being made or that are hurting the environment. So they can feel, they feel more meaningfully engaged and like they're actually making a difference. And so they really care to teach that farmer how to, you know, grow the sheep, work with the sheep differently or work the organic farmers or the dye houses, always looking for ways that we can make things different and better.
But isn't it? Wouldn't it be
good for business? Right, go ahead.
Would it be cheaper? Would it be better for your bottom line if you didn't take all of this care?
I don't know. I think totally in the total long term, no, would be my answer. I think you can look. You know, it's in certain ways, certain things are more expensive. You know, like. Organic cotton costs 15% more, you know, things like that. It does cost more. But the loyalty, I think, that the customers, you know, and you know, bring when they look at a garment, they want it, and then they realize, oh, that's kind of expensive. Oh, but it's organic. I can justify that. That's something meaningful, you know. And maybe at first they didn't care, and they're beginning to more and more be drawn in and care and feel proud of supporting a brand that's trying hard to make things right. So I think there's a long term. I'm lucky to be privately owned because if I had to report quarterly earnings all the time and justify, you know, these kinds of expenses, it might be harder. But the employees, like, you know, we had a meeting a number of years ago talking about the water crisis. And we had a couple different employees that stood up and said, take my profit sharing. What can we do? Can we donate it to support the water crisis? I mean, I think they really care.
That's pretty amazing. But you've had moments, real tough moments in business. The recession hit you hard.
Yeah.
You were hit hard by Hurricane
Sandy,
which
yeah.
destroyed a lot of your inventory,
yeah.
like $1.5 million and stuff.
Something like that, yeah.
Did you In moments like that, did you rethink some of your do-gooding?
No, never, never. I mean, there were moments that we had. I remember there was a moment, and that was 2008, but we had to pull back on our wellness benefit. We give $1,000 a year to every employee for additional kinds of wellness besides the regular medical benefits. So that's where the massages and, you know, yoga classes and all those kinds of things come in. So we had to pull back. I think we gave only half, and we, you know, of course, couldn't give profit sharing if there was no profit, that kind of thing. Our social consciousness work, I don't think we ever pulled back. We did pull back on some of our charity work. And one of the interesting things that happened, because we were giving, I think we give 5%, I don't know exactly what percentage we give, but at least that, to support women and girls and the environment and different charities and that kind of thing. So we had a lot of charities we cared a lot about, and that was 2008. And so we ended up out of this creating this recycle program as a way to get resources to support some of these organizations that we had to pull back on a little bit that we felt really uncomfortable about. And so we created this is, I love these problem-solving win-win things that happen. So we created this recycle program. We created it originally through the foundation with the idea of giving to those women's organizations. And then the recycle program grew so much. I mean, today it's employing, I don't know, at least 30 people, maybe more, just totally, you know, refurbishing the clothes and reselling them. And we sell, I don't even know, I better not quote the number, but a lot of recycled clothes. And that's taken us to another whole place. Now we have mounds of recycled. What I'm saying is that I think the commitment to the work, to the good work, is an important part of who we are. So we don't stop that. But we do have to, it's always, there's certain business decisions. And sometimes, like I was saying, around the charity piece, we had to pull back. But it created another whole program that's been really meaningful. And so I think there's, you know, just different ways around it.
That's a great story, because basically the intention remained to operate as an ethical business. And so when the resource picture shifted,
right,
it just found another outlet.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what would I would love to get your advice on a few things. So I'm oddly enough, a small businessman.
Yes.
I want to be clear. There's this company, this 10% happier company. I'm not the CEO. There's an actual business person, a young guy who's the CEO. So no, I don't run the thing. But, you know, I would love to hear your advice as we have this lean little startup. We're trying to survive.
Nice.
We're trying to make it.
Nice.
How much energy should we be putting toward making sure the employees are taken care of and making sure we're doing good in the world? You know, all of the things that you're now doing as a mature company.
Mm. Oh, goodness. I'm trying to remember how it was when I was small. And there was a moment in time I started giving 10% of the profits, and that was when there was extra profits. So, you know, if you're at that place where there's enough extra profits that you could share 10%, that would be a nice thing to do.
Yeah, I can't imagine us having any profits, but
okay.
Anyway.
Well, I can relate, because I'm also starting the Learning Lab, and I'm in that same kind of place with the Learning Lab. It's not profitable yet, so there's no profits yet to share. So, you know, but still, let's see, what do we do? We still ring the bell. what can you do? I think that, you know, the way we conduct meetings and the way we care about the people, and I think it probably, when you're really small and you're close to people, I think it's pretty natural, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
to
no, the
be with people in a way that, you know, that you care. It's when you start to get another step bigger that things start to get, no? Is that?
I think that's probably
that's
exactly
natural,
right.
That you're like a family and people care about each other and there's those basics.
They're based up in Boston, so for a bunch of reasons that are not going to be interesting, but it's a very small group, and the vibe, for lack of a better word, is extremely positive.
Yeah.
You know, there's a
yeah.
unity of purpose and
yeah.
all of those things.
Yeah.
But
do they meditate every day?
Yeah, everybody's serious meditator.
So nice.
It's great.
Yeah.
I don't monitor
you've got
their
it there.
Practice.
You don't have to do anything. It's all there.
It's there in a way, but we need to
what
make
would
sure.
What do you want to do? What else? Go ahead.
Well,
we need to make
I don't
sure.
know. I don't know, because I don't run anything before,
yeah,
so I don't
yeah,
know
yeah.
how much attention should I be paying to making sure that there's some sort of emotional care and feeding of these people. rallying of the troops. I don't know. This is all so new to me.
Yeah.
And there is a way in which when you're new and just trying to survive in a crowded marketplace that you can really be focused on that stuff and not focused on the things that you now spend a lot of time focusing on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, I don't personally focus on them either. I have people in culture, people who focus on those kinds of things.
But you've made it a priority for the company.
Yes.
And that's that is a form of focus.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I'm trying to think. Well, I'm thinking in the kind of organization that you have, that you probably wouldn't need things like coaches. You're probably not having problems where people are unaware of how they're impacting others and the way they speak and treat people. And,
maybe, but I'm not aware of those.
Yeah.
I'm probably the problem. I hope not.
I doubt it.
I was kidding, but then I realized maybe I was true.
Well, it's weird because we don't always know how people.
No, you don't know.
It's like I was thinking, this is, probably shouldn't tell the story, but my daughter was working for this guy. This is probably a terribly unrelated story, but it's just pointing out the unconsciousness that is in places where we don't know. I should probably tell more a story of myself. But anyway, my daughter was working for this man, fairly young man, who was, you know, kind of putting his arm around her and treating her in ways that felt like he was kind of acting like he was her girlfriend. His girlfriend, and she was getting really uncomfortable. And so one day she just sat down with him and said, you know, this is making me really uncomfortable. And he was like shocked. He was like, oh, wow, I'm sorry. I didn't even know. I didn't even think about it. And she said after that he was completely different, and they continued to work together and it was okay. But it was like he really honestly didn't understand how he was impacting her and that there was anything inappropriate about it. So I was so proud of her. But but I'm just saying, I think that was a kind of an extreme example maybe, but I think I do a lot of things. I had somebody tell me that I'm too critical one time, or people give me feedback that, you know, like, Eileen, I'm asking them now, you kind of, I lost you in that meeting somewhere. Where did you go? You kind of spaced out or something. So I'm asking people to give me feedback, like, tell me. That's one thing you could do.
Yeah.
Give me feedback.
So I could say to the folks in the company,
like, hey,
just make sure you tell me what I could do better on a regular, ask them regularly, what can I do better?
Yeah, yeah.
That's good.
Ask them one-on-one, too. That makes them feel safer, maybe. We can ask them in the group, too.
No, I think
tell them that you want to ask them and that they could think about it.
And then follow up.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, here's my other area of advice. You have how many kids?
Two.
And they're in their 20s?
Yeah.
So obviously we're at different stages of the life cycle.
Mine's
one and something.
Precious place. Be there as much as you can.
I'm trying.
That's my advice.
Absolutely.
That was my failure. If I have any regrets, boy, it's back to their infancy, their little childhood years, and I wasn't as present.
Because you were running this business.
Yeah, and I was always pulled in by it, and I always thought those problems and that work was more important. So that's my advice.
Are they mad about that now?
I think they've gotten over it, but I think that it wasn't helpful, you know. And then I ended up in a nasty divorce, and it was really complicated. I think it was, you know, really hard. That was the hardest.
I think about these issues all the time because the most precious resource is time.
Right.
And if you're busy, you were very busy.
Right.
And you are very busy, and I'm very busy. You know, how if you've got this kid and you're married and you want all that to be...
Right.
You want to be there for it, but you also don't want to screw up all the things that...
That you're trying to do.
Yes, it's a very tough balance.
Yeah. Don't you think meditation helps?
Absolutely. Here's why. I think because it's not so much about quantity of... This is going to sound like a super cliche thing to say, but it's not about the quantity of time. Yes, it is. I mean, you have to be there for enough time.
Yeah.
But when you're there, you got
to
actually
be there.
Not on
the
phone.
Be there. Exactly. And I used to read reports and watch them play on the floor, and, you know, rather than be there when I was there. I think that's the important thing.
So I try to do a little bit of that. You know, if I'm in the room with him, really get on the floor and hang around with him until he gets annoyed with me. And then I can read my phone or something like that. But I'm trying to toggle back and forth between taking care of business and making sure that I'm a father.
Yeah, that's good.
Or leave the phone aside. He's 20 months.
Oh, so he's still really young. So you're not at the place where you can teach him a little yoga or meditation. You can hang with him that way.
I mean, good luck.
Not yet. No.
Maybe four. He knows his numbers and letters and stuff like that. And I'm basically trying to teach him not to kill the cats or throw his food at his mom. Real basic stuff.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
I think when he stops pooping his pants, I can teach him to meditate. That's probably where that's the goal.
It's a great time, though.
It's great. It's phenomenal.
And just like I think your advice to yourself, just be there when you're there, is the most important.
The frustrating thing about being a parent for me, as somebody who's like built at least a part of his career on fighting against cliches, is that every cliche about parenting is true. They're all true.
Which ones are you thinking of?
It's the best and the worst simultaneously.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
You'll never love like this before. it goes so fast.
Right.
All of those things are incredibly true. And if you're reflexively pushing that stuff away, you're going to miss some important advice. Yeah. I was struck when I can't help it. I post pictures of him all the time on social media because I think he's really cute. And when he was born, I posted a few pictures and thousands of people were saying the same thing. They were saying, enjoy every moment.
Oh,
right? Man. And I thought, okay, this is just a boilerplate
cliche,
thing,
right?
You say. But actually, there's something there. There's signal in the noise.
Oh. Well, I'm so happy for you that you have that opportunity to make that choice now. Like when my kids were young, I didn't have the wherewithal or the tools to actually know that I could make that choice, that moment-to-moment choice.
Well, let me make a devil's advocate argument. What you said right there, you didn't have the wherewithal or the tools. You can't go back in time.
No.
But you have the wherewithal and tools now, and so you can use them
to
the
best of your
ability.
So I'm doing the best I can.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm really struggling. But that's a different story with my son in particular.
Is the meditation helpful?
To me? Oh, yes. Oh, my God. I couldn't do what I'm doing right now in the way I'm trying to be with him without it. I don't believe I could.
How do you think he would react if you said, before every discussion, we're going to ring a bell?
Well, sometimes I light a candle, so I get close.
How does he react to that?
I don't know if he... how does he react? I don't know. He's used to it. So
yeah,
it's just mom. It's just mom being mom.
Mm-hmm. Maybe for a 27-year-old, the thing to do is open a beer and give it to
him. Yeah, maybe. I'll try that one next
time. To channel my 27-year-old self. Okay, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please make sure to subscribe, rate us. And if you want to suggest topics we should cover or guests we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. I also want to thank heartily the people who produce this podcast and really do pretty much all the work. Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, Andrew Kalb, Steve Jones, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.